KALW.
We are deeply upset about the charges that are being brought against the Golden Gate 26.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are facing multiple felony charges.
The DA is arguing that by blocking the bridge, the protesters falsely imprisoned the commuters.
Today, we get an update on the Golden Gate 26. Then, a new play tells the story of enslaved Black people seeking freedom in Mexico.
There was an actual network of brown people helping Black people get into northern Mexico.
And we visit the heavyweight champions of Half Moon Bay.
They looked around and they saw pumpkins everywhere. So they decided, how about we have a pumpkin festival?
Celebrating the great and almighty gourd. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, an update on the pro-Palestinian protesters who blocked the Golden Gate Bridge back in April. The group has their next preliminary hearing on October 21st. San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins has charged the group with more than 40 counts, including multiple felonies. Reporter Chris Alam has been covering the case for El Intishar newspaper, and he joins me now to update us on where things stand. Hey, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us what happened back on April 15th. That was tax day.
Right. And that was intentional. It was a national day of action across several cities, including Miami, Seattle, Oakland, and LA. And here's how it happened in San Francisco. Basically, 26 protesters drove as a convoy onto the Golden Gate Bridge around 7 a.m., 8 a.m. during rush hour and stopped in the middle span of the bridge. The ones in the front cars got out, blocking each lane, and immediately unrolled a banner saying, "End the siege on Gaza now." Several chained themselves together through the cars. They managed to stop all traffic into the city for at least around 5 hours, 4 hours. 20 people were arrested. The specific charges they're all facing are conspiracy, false imprisonment, refusal to disperse, obstruction of a thoroughfare, and refusal to comply with a lawful police order. The felony charges are specifically for conspiracy and false imprisonment, which is pretty serious.
So can you tell us about the false imprisonment charge? What does that even mean in this case?
Right. Well, false imprisonment is legally defined as engaging in an act of restraint on another person, which confines them into a bounded area. Mm. An area is considered bounded if movement is limited in all directions. Basically, what's happening here is the DA is arguing that by blocking the bridge, the protesters falsely imprisoned the commuters on the bridge.
Uh-huh.
But the defense claims no one was literally trapped. I spoke to one of the defense attorneys, Jeff Wozniak. His argument is that people were able to exit their cars, walk around, and potentially could have walked off the bridge on foot if necessary. So under the definition of false imprisonment, he says these things would not have been possible.
So that was 5 or 6 months ago, though, and the court hearings are just now starting. Why? What's happening?
So it took DA Jenkins a few months to actually build the case up against them. The initial arraignment was back in September 16th. I showed up there early that day, and it was already a really huge crowd. People were packing the building, showing solidarity with the activists from, the security check all the way down to the courtrooms on both floors. It was really the busiest I'd ever seen the courts. I talked to one of them, Bridget Rochios, who said the group finds the charges ridiculous for the precedent it could set.
We are deeply upset about the charges that are being brought against the Golden Gate 26 and really concerned about what that means for the future and what that means for protesting and Palestinian solidarity, not only in the Bay Area, but across the United States.
So, Chris, this isn't the first time a bridge has been blocked because of protests, though.
Right. The Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge have been the sites of protests here for decades, especially in the form of blocking rush hour traffic. When it comes to this specific wave over Israel's war in Gaza, in November, 78 pro-Palestinian protesters blocked the Bay Bridge in a basically identical way to the Golden Gate 26. They chained themselves, blocked traffic going into the city. They blocked it during rush hour traffic for like 5 to 6 hours, and the police response was instant and massive, but they did not get charged the same at all. On top of that, this has been happening for decades.
Woody Harrelson walked out of jail in San Francisco, arrested today after pulling a very big, very high profile.
Again, 1997, the actor Woody Harrelson, he climbed the bridge with others mm-hmm. to protest the logging of ancient redwoods called the Headlands Forest.
And did Woody Harrelson get a felony?
He didn't, actually. In fact, he was given basically the same settlement as the Bay Bridge protesters. which was all of them paying a small restitution and performing community service. That's really been the norm.
So what is the difference between what's going on now and then? What's happening?
So I was at the Bay Bridge. There is essentially no difference. If anything, this one on the Golden Gate Bridge was smaller and slightly shorter. You know, also, it's worth considering Brooke Jenkins is up for re-election, so that might influence things. But I think one of the big differences in the charging decisions might be the idea of finding a victim.
So do you know if there are victims coming forward this time around? What's the basis of the DA's case?
Well, Brooke Jenkins went to the public on Twitter asking for victims to come forward. In this case, a victim would be anybody who felt they were harmed by the bridge stoppage,
okay,
which could be anything from someone missing a surgery, doctor's appointment, to someone who, you know, had to use the bathroom. The court documents for Golden Gate 26 says that 35 people initially contacted the police while they were stuck. And reports from those people include missing work, doctor's appointments. There was a mother without baby formula, and actually people who said they were holding their pee.
What does the defense say? We know they're fighting back on the false imprisonment charges.
They're saying the charges are out of proportion. Wozniak and the defense team are actually claiming that Jenkins' charges against the Golden Gate 26 are politically motivated based on some conduct in her office. And they're calling on her to recuse herself from the case entirely and pass it to the attorney general, who they expect will dismiss it.
So politically motivated? Tell me more.
They wrote a letter where they pointed to instances in her office of what they say is clear anti-Arab bias. And I think maybe the most significant claim that they're making in their demand for recusal has to do with the fact that Jenkins met with the Israeli consulate twice in the last year, and she was gifted a bottle of wine, which is, in general, not typical for DAs.
Okay, so what does Jenkins' office have to say about the accusations?
Well, of course, she refused to recuse herself based on what the defense has already raised. Her argument was that public officials meet with consular officials often, but she didn't detail her own activity necessarily, or if she has met with any other consulates. There's also no evidence that she ever received gifts from any other consulates. It's possible that people who want her to be tougher on crime are dissatisfied with how the Bay Bridge case turned out and could be supporting these felony charges. One of her old staffers is actually running against her. That's Ryan Kojaste. He was fired by Jenkins when she took office 2 years ago. He said seemingly without reason. He presents as a more progressive candidate than Jenkins, more of a restorative justice approach, reminiscent of George Gascon or Cheza Boudin. So based on the turnout in support of the protesters, he may have some supporters in this race. He also pointed out the high court costs in doing felony prosecutions for, you know, 8 to 26 people, and how the already backlog of violent cases will just be further delayed by this.
Okay, so Chris, what are you following next?
So the felony cases are having their next preliminary hearings on October 21st, with the misdemeanors being heard on October 24th. The defense is currently filing the formal motion for recusal against Jenkins. That might be heard before those preliminary hearings, but there's no date there yet. A motion of discovery to access more information on the DA's office is also being considered by the judge.
Okay, Chris Alam, thank you very much. We'll be following along with you.
Thanks, Anna. My pleasure.
That was Al Intishar reporter Christopher Alam. He was also part of our summer training program. You can find his work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. It ain't fall without pumpkins. And today we visit a special place that has some of the biggest in the world. Soon, growers from around the country will be hauling their gargantuan gourds, some the weight of a compact car, to the town of Half Moon Bay to see whose squash is the most sizable. Surrounded by miles of farmland, the coastal town is known as the pumpkin capital of the world and hosts an annual festival that celebrates the crop. In collaboration with Coastside News Group, Sebastian Mino Buccelli brings us the story of a grower competing in this year's competition.
Oh, gracias, gracias. Mira, aquí tenemos toda clase de tomates y de cherry tomatoes, mira. Y aquí,
wow.
Aquí mira los gourds.
Wow. I'm at a winery in Napa with Leonardo Ureña. He works as a landscaper here. By day, he maintains the gardens.
Mira, aquí estos son gourds de diferente tipo de gourds para la gente, para que miren.
But when he's off work, he tries to grow the perfect specimens of long gourds and giant pumpkins. The winery lets him experiment at a plot of land off to the side.
Aquí es donde estamos, en el cultivo de las calabazas.
We walk on a dirt road, past some grapevines towards his pumpkin field, and he shows me the pumpkins he's currently growing. They're light yellow, not your typical bright orange, and they're huge. We walk up to one, and he tells me it's estimated to be 1,500 pounds right now. That's the size and weight of a cow laying down. It's hard to believe these will get bigger, but he hopes they will. He's entering one of them in Half Moon Bay's annual pumpkin weigh-off next week.
Trofeos que hemos logrado en todos estos años de dos Half Moon Bay, tres El Grove, dos Heirloom Festival.
At his house a few miles away, Leonardo shows me some trophies he's won over the years.
This is the Longboard Grove of the Year.
He's most proud of two that he won in 2011 and 2019 for the biggest pumpkin. In last year's competition, he says he and his brother-in-law were the only two Latinos who entered pumpkins. Leonardo's pumpkin weighed 1,894 pounds, but still didn't come close to the winning one.
Oh my God, Half Moon Bay is in the record books. That's a world record! World record!
Travis Ginger from Minnesota broke the world record. His pumpkin came in at 2,749 pounds. That's nearly the weight of a small compact car. The competition is in its 51st year, and each year, the winning pumpkin tips the scale just a bit further, and everyone takes it pretty seriously. The weigh-off is officially sanctioned by the Great Pumpkin Commonwealth. They're like the governing body that every major professional sport has, like Major League Baseball. It's so serious that the county's agriculture director of weights and measures comes to town to verify that the scale is calibrated, because prize money is on the line.
I think we gave away almost $50,000 last year in prize money.
That's Cameron Palmer. He's one of the local organizers, and he's the MC of the Pumpkin Weigh-Off. Half Moon Bay locals know him from Cameron's Pub, a British theme bar off Highway 1. That's where I asked him about the history of the event. Half Moon Bay hasn't always been known for its pumpkins. Historically, farmers on the coast were growing peas, artichokes, Brussels sprouts. It wasn't until the 30s when farmers realized that pumpkins would also thrive in the coastal climate. And then in the early 70s, locals wanted to throw a festival to raise money for the town.
And they looked around and they saw pumpkins, pumpkins everywhere. So they decided, how about we have a pumpkin festival? The Great Pumpkin Weigh-Off started about 2 to 3 years after the first pumpkin festival.
He tells me in 1974, the city of Half Moon Bay boasted about being called the pumpkin capital of the world. Then Frank Barnhill,
the mayor of Circleville, Ohio, heard that we were boasting that, and he called up our mayor, Mayor Al Aldrovino.
They settled the dispute with the weigh-off by telephone.
Both mayors were on each end of the phone.
There were people on both ends to certify the weight, too.
And Half Moon Bay won by 1 pound. Of course, pumpkins back then were a big whopping 130 pounds, and that was the biggest pumpkin at the time.
John Manitis Sr. also grew a winning pumpkin that year. His pumpkin weighed 132 pounds, 100 times smaller than the recent winners. And his son, Tom Manitis, is still in the pumpkin business.
I don't enter anymore. Can't come near those guys. They're over in Washington and other areas.
And the winners now often come from other states, driving their giant pumpkins thousands of miles. Growers also get together around the world in clubs to exchange the seeds of giant pumpkins they grow. They'll crossbreed and experiment. Here's Cameron again.
They're usually Atlantic giant pumpkin seeds, and sometimes they'll, I don't know the technical term, but they'll like splice it with another pumpkin seed.
Okay, we're pulling up to the ranch side of Hudson.
In Napa, while showing me his pumpkins, Leonardo also tells me about his seeds. One seed he planted came from a grower in New York whose pumpkin grew to be 2,365 pounds.
Empecé tres aquí, nada más que aquella se me malogró. No sirvió, eh. Entonces la medio la abandoné, pero le sigo echando melaces para que atraiga las plagas allá y no me molesten acá.
It's hard to imagine that these two giant pumpkins started from a tiny pumpkin seed. He started three of them in a greenhouse 7 months ago. When they began to bloom, he pollinated them himself. That's because he doesn't trust the bees. When one of them died, he added molasses to it to attract pests, diverting them away from the remaining healthy two.
Tantas hojas, mira. Si tú miras todas estas, son de esa calabaza.
Wow.
Están, como quien dice, están como...
Leonardo also relies on the green leaves to help the pumpkins grow. He says they act like solar panels. They produce carbohydrates for the pumpkin and can help it gain 15 to 20 pounds a day.
Entonces, vamos para que la mires esta.
Yeah.
As we get close to one of his pumpkins, he shows me this trick to check if it's healthy.
Mira cuando tú le tocas acá arriba.
He says when you bump the pumpkin, it has to sound like you're bumping a tree trunk because it means it's solid. This one sounds good.
Cuando les pegas, que suena como un tambor, no es buena señal.
If it sounds like a drum, it's not a good sign. It means that it's hollow inside. He surveys his pumpkins every day and takes detailed notes of everything. And he has to abide by some pretty strict rules to compete. He can't tamper with a pumpkin to make it heavy or bring in one with rot.
Yeah. ¿Cuántos pies del tronco a la calabaza? Yes. 15. ¿Cuándo polinizaste? Junio 7.
Wow.
¿Y cuándo la cortaste? Octubre 13. Porque va a estar en 14 en Half Moon Bay.
This weekend, he'll ceremoniously cut the stem of the heaviest of the two pumpkins and use a forklift to get it into his truck before he makes the trip down to Half Moon Bay. He hopes he'll be a contender. But for Leonardo, it's not really about winning anymore. He does this for the fun of the game and to share his love of growing pumpkins with other competitors around the world. In Half Moon Bay, I'm Sebastian Minobuccelli for Cross Currents.
Half Moon Bay's Pumpkin Way Off is this Monday, October 14th, and the Art and Pumpkin Festival is held the following weekend, October 19th and 20th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Did you know that during slavery, Black people in Texas fled to Mexico for freedom? It's a route of the Underground Railroad that's not well known, but historians estimate that up to 5,000 people escaped bondage and crossed the southern border. This history inspired artists Brian Quijada and Nigel D. Robinson to create the musical Mexodus. It's currently running at the Berkeley Rep. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with the stars of Mexodus.
Brian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nigel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me too.
First of all, before I even just dive into the interview, congratulations on an amazing production.
Thank you.
Just amazing. I went opening night and the show was so good that Nigel and Brian received a long standing ovation before the show even ended. I didn't even know how the show was going to end. I didn't know how the story was going to end. And people were on their feet clapping. and cheering. That's how good it is.
Oh, my Lord. Halfway through the show, were you just like, that's it, we got to go?
Yep. And we were sitting there with our stage manager, like, well, and our sound engineer, Angela, we can hear her in our in-ears. And she was like, you guys need to take control of the show again. We need to move forward. And we're just sitting there like, I don't know what to do.
I'm sure you appreciated the break that you got because the show is so intense. Yeah. How did you even come across this history about enslaved people fleeing to Mexico?
Facebook did it. Somebody posted this article on history.com, the Undertold Story of the Underground Railroad that led south to Mexico. And I remember reading it and being like, whoa, I have never heard of this. And then after reading it, being like, well, that makes sense. Especially, you know, because you're just like, Mexico abolished slavery before the United States did. It would make sense. And so I sat on that idea for a really long time because I'm like, well, I'm not going to write this alone. That seems bonkers. And when I met Nigel, I'm like, oh man, this guy seems like the perfect partner to make this with.
That's amazing.
I think it's really important that we like show the relationship between Black and Brown people because we're so easily divided because you can say that the Brown immigrant is taking away from the Black American. But you know, things can be put in ways like that, but this is a story of like, there was an actual like network of people, Brown people helping Black people get into Northern Mexico. So like, and then that paralleling like hip hop being born and created by these Black and Brown people in the Bronx and like the Black Panther movement and the Young Lords movement working in the barrio together. And like just these moments of collaboration and unity between these two communities, I thought that this was like really important to like showcase that, like, here's how it kind of start contemporarily speaking, like, this is how it kind of started in the United States.
Let's talk about the music.
Let's go.
Okay. I know this is being promoted as a hip hop show, but there's hip hop, jazz, blues, Mexican bolero, Negro spirituals, reggaeton. I know I didn't miss some stuff. Y'all have picked up every instrument I can think of in this play, especially Nigel. Strings, piano, horn, percussion. I mean,
everything.
When Nigel started playing bottle wind chimes, I was done. I said, if he picks up one more instrument. and you all are like, you're doing this in real time. You have the loop machine and you're making these beats and making these sounds in real time. That's what I said. And they put in, for folks listening, they put a lot of work into this, I'm telling you. And I sat up very close. So I saw the sweat and like just the labor they put into this real up close. Where did the idea come from using a loop machine?
Yeah, I mean, when I met Nigel and he was playing all these instruments and I came up to him and said, yo, I'm like, yo, bro, do you loop? He's like, no. And I'm like, you would destroy everything. You would take over the world if you got on a loop machine and did all that. And sure enough, you know, he picked it up very quickly and is blowing a lot of minds. And it's amazing and it's so cool. But I think outside of just seeing a lot of looping potential when I met Nigel, I think that the show has a lot of themes of the constant work that it takes as people of color, obviously with a history of slavery, and also just the immigrant experience is one that is just constantly trying to pull yourself up from your bootstraps, mm-hmm. constant work, trying to make something of yourself and having little help. It's the basis of which looping was born out of.
I love your costumes.
Thank you.
Because they're nods to the past and the present. And Brian, your costume is an Adidas tracksuit with sneakers, which is, you know, a nod to hip hop. And then you have embroidery that you see on Mexican attire and spurs on your sneakers and a cowboy hat. So just, and it works. And you know, that's a throwback to the ranchers and the cowboys in Mexico. And Nigel, you have on baggy jeans, Tim's, very hip hop, suspenders, one hanging. That's 90s hip hop. That's what came for me. I love the patch on your pants because it reminds me of a quilt. Mm. So I was thinking enslavement too.
Like, to add on what Brian was saying about why looping and why that machine, like, not only are we like sampling history and sampling these things, but we're showing that it's all a loop. And that's why, like, you buy Brian being in a tracksuit with a cowboy hat and with this embroidery and spurs, because it's like, we're never too far away from 200 years ago at any given moment. And, you know, I take off that hoodie and it's like, whoa, we just went back 200 years. But like, when you put that hoodie back on, it's like, we're in 2024. And David was really big about how do we make this show look like both. By like taking one thing off, it turns into something totally different. Put it back on, it turns into something totally different. So like, it goes along the lines of like these loops. Like, we're always in a cycle and we're always going back to where we were.
That was Brian Quijada and Nigel D. Robinson speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel, and there was a lot more to it that you can hear at KALW.org/crosscurrents. Mexodus is running at the Berkeley Rep until October 20th. Today's Cross Currents team includes Eliza Peppel, Jan Ramirez, Clara Camunde, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.